Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Larry Reed. I'm president of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and I want to welcome all of you to our Issues and Ideas Forum today. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, who is an old friend of my personal friend and a great friend of the Mackinac Center. Some 12 years ago, he and I and our board chairman and others from around the state made a great trip to South America to about four countries and learned a lot and had a great time. And this is only the second time since that trip that we've prevailed on DeRoy to come back to Michigan. And today, at this luncheon, he is giving one of several addresses for us around the state. DeRoy is a New York commentator and a syndicated columnist with the Scripps Howard News Service. He's also a senior fellow with the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, which supports hundreds of free market think tanks all over the world. His weekly column reaches approximately 400 newspapers nationwide, and he's a frequent guest on a variety of national television and radio outlets. As a public speaker, he has lectured and debated at Rutgers, Stanford, and Tulane universities, Boston College, the Council on Foreign Relations, the National Academy of Sciences, the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation. It goes on and on. And he is here today to talk to us on a very timely subject, global capitalism, the virtue of market economics. Ladies and gentlemen, DeRoy Murdoch.
Well, thank you very much, Larry, for that kind introduction. Good afternoon to all of you. And let me say thank you to the Mackinac Center, not just for bringing me out here to Michigan. It's been quite a few years since I've been out here, and it's great to be back. But I want to thank the Mackinac Center for its constant efforts to advance the ideas of free markets, free minds, and free individuals, and the effort to try to bring those ideas to the state of Michigan and affect public policy in a way that advances human freedom. I want to say thank you to all of you for being here today. It's a gorgeous day outside, sunny, warm, crisp, gorgeous, and the sky's about the color of my shirt. It'd be very easy to be under a tree enjoying a nice lunch outdoors, and yet here you are, indoors on this gorgeous day, listening to me talk about public policy. So thank you very much for being here. Curious, do we have any Dear Abby fans here? Show of hands. We got a few. Very good. I happened to read this Dear Abby on the United Airlines flight out here. I thought it was fascinating. I'll read it to you. It's very, very interesting stuff. It says, Dear Abby, help. My husband cheats on me. Whenever I confront him, he lies about it. Then he cheats again. On top of that, everybody knows he cheats on me. Since our daughter left home for college, he hasn't even looked at me. These days, he just sits around and watches TV all day long while I earn the household income. Abby, what should I do? Signed, Desperate. Abby writes back, Dear Desperate, dump him. Since you became U.S. Senator from New York, you don't need him. Well, with the help of Daniel Montgomery and Bruce Walker on audiovisual, I'd like to draw a contrast this afternoon between the ideas of two major thinkers. Karl Marx, of course, was the 19th century German philosopher who, along with Friedrich Engels, was one of the two daddies of socialism and communism. I will speak much more about an idea credited originally to Adam Smith, the 18th century Scottish economist and author of The Wealth of Nations. This idea has been advocated by many people, not least among them Milton Friedman, the Nobel laureate in economics who passed away last November at the age of 94. And this idea was promoted most forcefully in our lives by this man, Ronald Wilson Reagan. He brought down communism's Berlin Wall without firing a shot and set the stage for the greatest acceleration in free markets in human history. His tax cuts and other reforms are the gifts that keep on giving. The New York Stock Exchange is sort of the Vatican of global capitalism. Its marble columns and Roman facade almost make the place look like a free market church. The traders inside, or worshippers, if you will, do more than simply buy and sell securities. They represent an economic system with highly positive moral value, which is what I will try to demonstrate today. Capitalism these days is largely interlaced with globalism. As our economy has grown more internationally linked, it has become essentially impossible to separate oneself from the global economy. Let's imagine, for example, that you're a protectionist or an economic nationalist. You're not crazy about these free market ideas and free trade and so on. You think we ought to protect our economy, and you try to live that way. You just hate globalization. You happen to be on a business trip, and you rent a Dodge PT Cruiser, a good old all-American car. Well, it turns out it was produced by Daimler Chrysler, until recently a half-American, half-German company. You growl quietly to yourself. You get to the airport and you board the most patriotic jet you can find. It's an American Airlines 747 built in Seattle, damn it, right here in America. But wait, you look out the window and its engines are made by Rolls-Royce, a British company. You decide to write your senator to demand higher trade barriers against these awful foreign goods. But you misspell his name. It's Carl Levin with a C, not a K. So you get out your eraser and you erase it and put Carl with a C, not a K. Anyway, little do you realize that your pencil eraser, right at the end of your pencil right there, is made of rubber from Malaysia. You finally make it home and turn on your TV set, and what are they showing on television but Titanic? You think, what a great night to watch Titanic. And then you remember that movie stars Kate Winslet, that English actress. It's directed by James Cameron, a Canadian. And its leading man is Leonardo DiCaprio. And that doesn't sound very American, now does it? So you whip out your cell phone, which is made by Nokia, a Finnish company, and you do what any red-blooded American would do. You stay home and order in Chinese food. I think this cartoon sums it up nicely. You've got some auto workers here sitting in a bar having drinks after their shift. One of them is reading a headline that says, Toyota tops Chrysler. And the one on the left says, those expletive-deleted Japanese and their American-built models beat our German-run company that builds vehicles in Canada with parts from Mexico. And the other auto worker says, globalization's really taken the oomph out of Japan bashing. I thought I would speak today about free market economics and its benefits for regular people. Capitalism is great for capitalists, but works wonders for regular Joes and Janes, too. As America enjoys its 22nd quarter of economic expansion, the lessons are clear. From America's central business districts to the farthest corners of the third world, market economics do wonderful things for individuals and societies. Let me list a few of capitalism's virtues. Specifically, a free market economy increases human freedom, boosts prosperity, improves human health and safety, and even advances peace. Now, what are the pillars of a free market economy? This usually involves societies where, A, people are free to own and exchange private property back and forth among themselves. B, government is limited in its activities and expenditures. It's not involved in every single solitary aspect of your life. It lets you get on with your business most of the time. C, taxes are low enough so that people can keep the lion's share of what they earn in wages and profits, something that I understand is not happening in this state at the moment. They also enjoy incentives to work, save, invest, and produce. D, people are free to be entrepreneurs, start companies, and market their innovations. E, free trade allows people to exchange their property across international borders with low tariffs and little interference from government, if any. F, government will not debauch the currency by printing worthless paper tickets. A dollar today is worth a dollar tomorrow, which is something I think the people of Canada are learning today. G, the rule of law. Government and citizens live by well-established procedures that protect individual freedom, not the capricious whims of unpredictable despots. Now, this is sort of an ideal picture I'm painting for you. Not even the United States lives up necessarily to all of these principles as much as yours truly and the board and staff of the Mackinac Institute might like, Mackinac Center might like. But if you look around the world, you'll generally find that as conditions like these on the screen emerge, even marginally, people start to become better off. They become more prosperous, they have more choices, and their futures brighten. Let's visit a few spots around the world and see how these free market conditions advance liberty and prosperity, improve human health and safety, and even promote peace. Let's start with California. And this is something done by the Sphere Institute, taking a look at the population of California, dividing them up by quintiles, 20% in each category. What they find is the rich are getting richer, but the poor are getting richer as well. Look how much people moved up the income ladder between 1988 and 2000. If you start with the top quintile, the people who are making the most money, they went from 74,800 and change up to about 80,000. Their incomes increased about 7.2% over this 12-year period between 1988 and 2000. Moving next up the ladder, the fourth quintile, people moved up about 9.5% in terms of their incomes. people right in the middle quintile, the middle 20%, over that 12-year period, their incomes increased 18%. The second quintile, these are people not at the bottom, but a little bit above, their incomes increased 29%. And the bottom 20%, the bottom quintile, those people in the lowest 20% of the income distribution, they saw their incomes grow 107% over that 12-year period. So here you saw the rich getting richer, but the poor getting richer, and at a much faster rate. This cartoon, I think, nicely makes the point with no numbers. You've got this poor guy from a very backward country holding up a little bowl for some food, and he's talking to an activist with a Save the Planet t-shirt, and he says, "Help us on the way, dude. We're stopping construction of that exploitive Nike plant in your village." Economic freedom, economic growth, free trade, and technological innovation help move people from poverty to progress. Let's take a look at Chile. Very thin country in South America. That's, in fact, where I met Larry Reed and many members of the Mackinac Center who are here today. And you look at this very, very thin country all the way at the far end of the earth as you approach the South Pole, and it's very interesting how they have managed to improve themselves. You take a look at some numbers, for example. This one is probably very hard for you to read. It's also in Spanish, so I will translate this for you and try to read you some of the figures in case some of you are having a little trouble reading these. Basically what happens is there's something called the Map of Extreme Poverty, which was done by a number of social scientists in Chile. And they traveled up and down Chile in the 1970s to try to get a sense of which communities were prosperous, which were kind of working class, which were some, you know, working poor, and then which ones were really destitute or extremely poor, people who were not developed and very backward in every sense that you could imagine. And they tried to determine where these different communities were. And their sense was that the government would focus on its public assistance resources on extremely poor people, people in really dire straits. They would improve the economy by liberating it, so people who were working poor or working class could move up and become more prosperous. And of course, the rich didn't need any help, so the government didn't bother helping them out. Unlike this country, where we give a lot of subsidies to very rich people. If you look at the Farm Bill, for example, the members of the Rockefeller family who get farm subsidies, you might be interested to know. Anyway, they looked around at the poor, very poor, extremely poor areas of Chile, and they discovered some fascinating things comparing 1970 and 1990. For example, infants who died from diarrhea, if you can imagine such a horror, went from 14.6 per thousand in 1970 to just 0.4 per thousand in 1990, 20 years later. The percentage of the population suffering from malnutrition dropped from 15.5% down to 8%, cut in half in 20 years. If you look at these couple bottom figures there, percentage of the population in urban areas with access to clean running water increased from 1970, 67%, all the way up to 97%, almost 100%, 20 years later. In rural areas, the number of people with access to clean running water went from 34% up to 86%, almost the whole country in the rural areas. Next slide. Look at the second from last column, second from the right column. This is infant mortality in Chile. Going back to 1960, that out of 1,000 live births, 125 of those, 12.5% of these kids died as infants from infantile diseases. 1970, that number had fallen to 82 per 1,000. 1980, 10 years later, dropped to 33. 1990, cut in half to 16. And then 2003, cut in half again to 8.3. You see just between 1970 and 2003, it's gone from 82 per 1,000 down to about 8 per 1,000, so a 90% drop in infant mortality in one generation. One more slide. And here you see the percentage of the population in extreme poverty. 1970, 21%, 1982, 14%, 12% in 1992, and by the year 2000, dropped all the way down to 8%, about a two-thirds reduction in extreme poverty. Now, how did Chile accomplish this much progress in economics and human health in so little time? During and after the rule of dictator Augusto Pinochet, Chile privatized state companies, reduced tariffs and cut taxes, and invented the idea of private pension funds or private social security accounts. Chilean workers are required to save for their own retirement, but unlike us Americans, they were given the option to invest that money privately in accounts that they, rather than the government, would own and control. An idea that we have discussed this country, but they in fact have done, and we continue to merely to discuss. Today, 7.6 million Chileans choose from among six private pension administrators whose portfolios are regulated to ensure diversification and safety. These funds have grown an average of 10% above inflation annually since 1981 when they began, and they never have lost a peso. The Chilean savings rate grew to 1/4 of gross domestic product, much above ours. This new capital accumulation in pension funds equals 80% of GDP, gross domestic product, and has helped boost Chile's growth rate from an historical average of 3% to about 7% over the last decade and a half. This growth rate, by the way, doubles gross domestic product every decade and quadruples it every 20 years, which leads to more and more wealth for the entire society to share. No wonder Chile continues to lead Latin America toward greater progress. In fact, Chile just was admitted to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, also known as the OECD, which is the so-called Club of Rich Countries. Let's take a look at New Zealand, the other side of the planet. New Zealand once had a massive public sector that absorbed tax money, spent it on a wide variety of activities, and kept that country backward and poor. In the mid-1980s, a reformist government decided to limit the state's grip on society. New Zealand now is rated by the Wall Street Journal and the Heritage Foundation as Earth's fifth freest economy. Maurice McTeague was a cabinet minister in New Zealand. Not long ago, in Regulation Magazine, he wrote about the dreadful telephone service that he and his countrymen had to endure in New Zealand. In the late 1980s, the government phone monopoly offered two varieties of telephones, black and white. Each one had a rotary dial face on it, rather than push buttons. You remember the rotary dial phones? They had those into the 1980s. The phone system was overloaded daily between 9:30 in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It usually took 20 minutes just to get a dial tone. Stockbrokers used to call the stock exchange at 8 in the morning and leave their phone lines open and off the hook all day long because they barely could get lines free the rest of the day. In 1989, the government sold off 100% of the state phone company for $4.2 billion. They just said, that's it, we're out of the telephone business. The company's workforce fell from 22,000 union-mandated public positions to just 7,000. Today, telephones are installed in 24 hours rather than the 3 months that they took when the government was in control. Thanks to competitors who've entered the market, prices for residential calls have fallen 54%, while business prices have plunged 64%. Now, what about all those unemployed telephone workers? You might be concerned that they continue to suffer unemployment. Well, 7 companies joined Telecom New Zealand in the national phone market. Due to the needs of those firms, total telecom employment recently stood at 35,000. That equals 13,000 more telecom positions than existed when government was the only operator in town. The government also got totally out of the farm business. They said, we're done, no more farm program, we're out of here. In 1985, the government repealed all forms of subsidies or support for agriculture. The whole lot, Mr. McTeague told me. The agriculture ministry shrank by 55%. The survivors there today focus on 2 things, food safety and trade agreements. Mr. McTeague adds, farmers' energy and inventiveness have gone into their productivity rather than arguing with bureaucracies for greater levels of support. So, did the farmers fail when they had to stand on their own feet without the government's assistance? On the contrary, tiny New Zealand has become Earth's largest dairy exporter. Its lamb, its venison, and its beef and fish have moved, as Mr. McTeague puts it, from more or less bargain basement commodities to the top of the restaurant trade. If you go to a restaurant tonight and order a rack of lamb, there's a very good chance that you're going to have New Zealand lamb. Back when they started this, they were basically serving kind of cafeteria-grade lamb, and now it's what you'd find at the finest restaurants in this country. New Zealand farmers never had it so good, thanks to a government that stopped suffocating them with subsidies, competitors who gave them a run for their money, and foreign customers who tried their products and loyally kept paying for them. I think that's something that the U.S. Congress ought to consider as it takes a look at what is now a $286 billion farm bill for the next 5 years. Maybe they'll vote it down, based on the New Zealand example. Let's talk about Ireland and its tax structure. Until recently, Ireland was the poor cousin of Western Europe. Unemployment and economic stagnation were common. These days, Ireland has staged a dramatic turnaround while Dublin has become a high-tech boomtown. What happened? Ireland joined the supply-side revolution. It cut its 32% corporate tax rate to just 12.5% for manufacturing and international financial services companies. Entrepreneurs and overseas industrialists responded by fueling foreign investment onto the Emerald Isle. Ireland recently began seeing over 40% of U.S. investment in Europe's electronics sector. Fully 1/3 of the computers sold in continental Europe are Irish computers. The Irish people are enjoying sizzling economic growth as a consequence of these free market public policies. In the last few years, their economy grew on average about 10%. These tax reductions, by the way, did not dry up the national treasury, causing the abandonment of infants and old people, as critics predicted. In fact, even with these tax cuts, corporate receipts grew by 45% since 1992, which, by the way, is the experience in this country with the reduction in corporate taxes and capital gains taxes. We're now bringing in more money than we did with the higher tax rates. Thanks to low taxes, Ireland's gone from a backwater to a beacon of high technology, increased opportunity, and growing incomes. The Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal this year rated Ireland the 7th freest economy on earth. Now let's take a look at the economic freedom of the world. And this is a study done by a number of think tanks around the world. And what they do essentially is rate countries on their levels of economic freedom or lack of economic freedom. And the principles they use are the kinds of things that I mentioned earlier: personal choice rather than collective choice, voluntary exchange coordinated by markets rather than political processes, freedom to enter and compete in market activity, and protection of persons and their property from aggression by others. Let's take a look at the next slide. If you take a look here, what they essentially have done is taken countries and divided them up into four categories. Those that are least free, those that are a little more free, those that are not completely free, and then free economies. And what you find here on one measure after another is that people who live in free market economies do better in almost any measurement you want as opposed to those in less economically free countries. For example, you take a look at GDP per capita income, and you find in the least free countries, places like Libya, places like Chad, places like the Sudan, places like Venezuela perhaps even, you'll find people making about $3,000 per year in 2003. You go up the freedom scale a bit, people are making about $4,800. You go up to countries like Brazil, which are not as free as ours, but somewhat freer, a little less free, I should say. They're making about $10,300 or so. And then you move on to the most free countries, places like the United States, Great Britain, and Japan, and you see a GDP per capita of about $24,000. Next slide. What if you're in the lowest 10%, you're the bottom of the rung, lowest 10%? Again, you want to be in a freer economy rather than one that's less so, even though you might think the less free countries would be more compassionate, perhaps. Again, in the least free countries, you see people living on $826 a year in the bottom 10%. People a little bit freer than that, about $1,100. Above that, $2,300. And then here again, in the cold-hearted capitalist countries like the U.S. and Canada and Australia, people are living on about $6,500 a year on average in the lowest 10% of the economy. If you're unemployed, you want to be unemployed in a free market society, not one that is less so. You see unemployment rates in these unfree countries on average, 2003 of 12.7%. Those a little bit freer than that, 10.8. Those a little more free than that, 10.6. And again, in most free countries on average, 5.9%. And 5.9% that you see as the average unemployment rate in 2003 in the most free economies, that number, by the way, is lower than the Michigan unemployment rate, which I believe is 7.4%. So Michigan finds itself somewhere not in the most free category, but approaching that second-tier category. And I dare say that the tax increases that took place here in this town, I think it was last week, that is not going to improve that situation. That's going to make it worse. And unfortunately, people are packing up and leaving Michigan because they see nearby states and other places in the United States more attractive for business. Now have been given that much more reason, that much more impetus, that many more incentives to pack their bags and unfortunately leave your state and go be neighbors of other people than you good people in this room. And that's a shame that the government of Michigan has done this. Next slide. How about infant mortality? If you're an infant and you want to grow up to adulthood, you don't want to do it in a least free country, you want to do it in a more free country. Out of 1,000 live births in the least free country, 72.4 infants will die before they exit childhood. And those a little bit more free, 47.2. The second ranked category, 22.7. And here are the most free economies where people say, you know, we're too greedy to care about the kids. Well, only 6 out of 1,000 are dying of infant mortality in the most free societies. Now, let's see if I got one more. What's the next one? Let's see life expectancy. Thank you. And then ultimately, how long we live. How much time do you have on Earth? Again, you want to be in a most free society rather than one less so. In the least free countries, people live to be 55. Those next up, about 63 years, 69 in the second tier categories. And in the most free societies like ours, people are living almost 78 years on average. Life expectancy, in fact, is over 23 years longer in countries with the most economic freedom than it is in those with the least. Countries with less economic freedom are actually knocking people off about 23 years sooner than we do. Anybody know what that is? Shout it out if you know. Indochina? Korea. It is Korea. That's right. This is a picture of the Korean Peninsula by day. And if these graphs don't convince you of the relationship among freedom and prosperity and human well-being, perhaps this will. This is a satellite picture of the Korean Peninsula by day, and here's how it looks at night. Down below, you see South Korea, which practices these free market principles we've been discussing. They've got limited government. They allow people to engage in free trade and business. And you see the bright lights of Seoul as people go out to dinner and go shopping and perhaps play tennis or soccer, enjoy themselves. People, I think, down in Busan, I think it is, down below. And then you see North Korea. You see a little tiny, tiny bit of light about there. Barely can see it. That little tiny bit of light is Pyongyang. Those that might be Kim Jong-il's the balcony lit up or something like that. The sun goes down in North Korea, and pretty much you go home and I guess complain about things quietly around candlelight with your friends and your neighbors and your relatives. And not much else goes on. I think this very dramatically shows the difference between capitalism and socialism about as starkly as is possible. Now, what was that I said about peace? Free markets advance peace as well. Look, for example, at Chile and Argentina. Back in December 1978, these two military governments, or military governments both in Chile and in Argentina, nearly launched a war over three small disputed islands in the Beagle Channel, way down there by the South Pole. I talked to a friend of mine, Daniel Pereira, who is a think tank leader in Mendoza, Argentina. That's where they grow excellent grapes that grow into Malbec wine and this terrific red wine the Argentines make, which I highly recommend. And he said that his town, Mendoza, right up next to the Andes, in 1978, he was standing on his front lawn looking up at these big searchlights, which the Argentine military had lighting up the skies because they expected the Chilean bombers to come in over the Andes and start bombing Argentina in this dispute over the Beagle Channel Islands. Fortunately, that didn't happen, and the bombing didn't take place. Those planes were not deployed. And now people in Mendoza don't spend their time looking up in the skies waiting for the Chilean bombers to arrive. They're engaging in commerce, trading goods and services back and forth over the Andes, and in fact through a tunnel that connects the two. Much different situation, which I think has helped bring peace to that area. Look at Vietnam. Vietnam used to be very belligerent with its neighbors. It's now at peace with Cambodia. Vietnam also briefly battled with China, and that front now also is peaceful. Now, there are political and diplomatic reasons for this, but part of that peace, I believe, likely in Vietnam, is that Vietnam is trying to maintain its attractiveness to international investors and tourists. Let's look at the Heritage Index of Economic Freedom. This is put out by the Heritage Foundation every year, rating countries for their economic freedom or lack thereof. And they do a map of the world where they color-code countries based on their levels of economic freedom or lack of freedom. And you see, for example, the free countries like the United States, like Australia, like Great Britain, those are all in blue. Mostly free countries like Peru, for example, South Africa are in green. Mostly unfree countries like Brazil and China are in yellow. And then you look at the red or repressed countries. Those are the least economic free countries. And you'll see that a lot of the Middle East is in red. You'll see that Venezuela is in red as well. What you very often find is a correlation between lack of economic freedom and political repression, political violence, sectarian strife, people being blown up. And that's another point, is that economically free countries, people tend not to blast each other to bits. And in those where they're less free, you're more likely to see that kind of thing. So, why is this man smiling? Every May Day, Marxists celebrate the collective ownership of the means of production. Before the Berlin Wall was chiseled into bric-a-brac, May Day brought forth red flags, goose-stepping soldiers, and ballistic missiles strapped to mobile launchers. These days, thankfully, such pageantry is limited to Havana, Cuba, and Pyongyang, North Korea. Yet Marx's disciples may have the last laugh. Karl Marx himself will be amazed to see how much his ideas thrive here in the USA. In a study titled Marxism, American Style, Mark Schmidt of the National Taxpayers Union observes that, quote, most American adults weaned on a steady diet of anti-communism would be shocked to learn the magnitude of the role that Karl Marx's utopian vision plays in contemporary society in this country. Schmidt compared the German philosopher's 1848 Communist Manifesto with the United States today. The parallels are ominous. Marx and his co-author Friedrich Engels demanded a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. Jackpot. What do we have in the United States? A progressive federal income tax, starting with a 10% tax rate for those in the lower incomes, then moving up to 15, 25, 28, 33, and 35%. You compare this system of progressive multiple tax rates with Russia's, of all places. Russia, where Karl Marx's ideas reigned with deadly consequences. Russia has swapped Marx's progressive tax regime for supply-side 13% flat income tax. And for all the trouble that Russia is suffering right now in terms of its political situation, its economy has been thriving. They're bringing lots of revenue. And this 13% flat tax in Russia has been very good for the Russian economy. And Russia, of all places, is now to the right of the United States on tax. Who saw that coming? In addition to these multiple tax rates, we have a very complex tax system in the United States. You can imagine these being books on the shelf of a tax attorney, and you can see from the time it started until today how more and more books get put on the shelf of that tax accountant or tax attorney. On the next slide, you actually can see the numbers increase. Back when the income tax started, we had a tax code of about 400 pages. 1974, we had under 20,000 pages. 1995, 40,500. Just 6 years, 7 years ago, year 2000, we had 46,900 pages. And last year, we had 66,498 pages of tax code laws, regulations, IRS tax rulings, and other guidelines that guide that steer our tax system. You ask five accountants for an opinion on a particular transaction, you'll get at least five different answers as to what the correct amount is you should pay. You call the IRS and ask them for advice. Different people at the IRS, when they pick up the phone, will give you different advice as to what you ought to do and what you ought to pay. It's a giant black hole. Nobody knows what's in it. And I think what we ought to do is take the whole thing, scrap it, and replace it with a voluntary flat tax. Applaud. Let me not hold you back if you want to applaud. I think what we ought to do with the tax code is make it voluntary. So if you like this tax code, and you may have certain circumstances where your particular investment pattern, or maybe you've got a bunch of different businesses, and maybe it's to your benefit to deal with this whole giant tax code, in which case, great, marvelous, keep on keeping on. However, we will have an optional flat tax of, I think, 10% would be a good number, maybe 15 at the top end, and make that an option. And if you want to do that, great. You may file on a little postcard and send in 10% or 15% of your income, and you're done with it. And make it optional. Make it something people can choose one way or the other. People will be more happy. The economy will be more efficient. And those people who like this can do that. And those people who want to file on a postcard will be free to do that. And I think everyone will feel much, much better. Karl Marx called for confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels, affluent Americans who renounced their citizenship and more to lower taxes. Affluent Americans who renounced their citizenship and moved to lower tax countries remain subject to federal taxation on U.S. income for 10 years after they depart. They also may not return to America. Says Dan Mitchell of the Free Market Cato Institute, it's like a Soviet-style exit tax that shakes you down one more time on the way out the door. Abolition of all right of inheritance was another Marxist prescription. While Americans can inherit property, large estates suffer the 50% federal death tax, such as is happening perhaps here. While it will phase out by 2010, it is scheduled to zoom back up to 55% in 2011. You can imagine what kind of perverse incentives that will create. To reduce or avoid such confiscation, Americans spend some $25 billion annually to confound death tax laws. And by coincidence, that roughly equals the revenue that the death tax brings in. We're spending as much to avoid the death tax legally as we are collecting in terms of revenue for the U.S. Treasury. Washington, D.C.'s Free Enterprise Fund worked this year to see the death tax killed and buried permanently. The fund's TV commercials carried a simple message, no taxation without respiration. The Communist Manifesto also counsels centralization of credit in the banks of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. Karl Marx, meet Alan Greenspan. The world-famous Greenspan, of course, has been succeeded by the lower-profile Federal Reserve Chairman Benjamin Bernanke. The Federal Reserve Bank, worshipped as a cornerstone of capitalism, in fact, is a spectacularly statist institution. It wields the power to create money and control interest rates and inflation. The 12-member Federal Open Market Committee is essentially a financial politburo that secretly meets to fix the cost of capital. Karl Marx called for abolition of property in land and application of all rents of land to public purposes. While Marx likely would frown on America's widespread private ownership of homes and farms, he'd be delighted by the vast acreage in the federal government's hands. Uncle Sam owns 62% of the square footage west of the Rockies and a whopping 84.5% of Nevada. Compare that to federal property ownership in Michigan, which is roughly 10%. I understand the state government owns quite a bit of property, but the federal share of your land here in Michigan is about 10%. Despite this massive portfolio, much of it poorly maintained, which is evidenced by these wildfires that burn through the federally owned forests and federally owned property every fall. You see millions of acres burn. Washington typically spends about $500 million annually to acquire even more private land on top of the public land that it can't maintain already, using your tax dollars for that purpose. Still, Mark Schmidt adds that all this does not make America communist. This is the best place in the world to live, he says, but we have a strong current of collectivist ideology that runs just beneath the surface. Now, are free markets perfect? I think this cartoon might illustrate that. Here we have a poor guy in the third world holding a sign that says no free trade, and he says that's all, no food, no help, just a sign. And the guy who's wearing the backpack that says wacko and the t-shirt that says I'm with stupid says, of course, that's not all. Here, have a gas mask. In conclusion, free markets don't do everything for everybody. They have yet to cure the common cold, for example. Although I would recommend taking Zicam whenever you get that scary tickle in the back of your throat. It's a wonderful product and scares colds away. But by creating wealth, market economies worldwide produce the resources to propel human advancement and leave enough afterward to give charitable aid and comfort to those who stay behind through no fault of their own. So if you care about the workers of the world, remember to pray for the capitalists too. There they are. And here at home, always remember the system and the nation that nurture them both so well. Thank you very much.